This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast. This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts.
St. Louis is home for conservative talk.
You're listening to the Mark Reardon Show.
Well, Billy Joe and Sting, Friday night, Busch Stadium. We're going to keep our fingers crossed on the weather. Dave Murray will join us tomorrow with a preview, and he's coming in town from the Evolution Festival, so we'll have Dave in studio on Friday. And I mentioned tomorrow afternoon, 4:25, Mike Del Judas, who is in Billy Joel's band. He's got an amazing story. He was asked to join the band a decade ago after having his own Billy Joel tribute cover act called Big Shot.
He sounds like him.
Oh, yeah. It's great. Billy says, I was in a, you know, listening to a rehearsal. He thought it was a recording of his own voice. And, yeah. You know, they said, no, Billy, that's guy Mike Del Judas. And then he invited him to join the band. It really is a crazy story, and he's a great guy. And you'll see him at the show. Billy gives him a little solo spot where he covers a song or he sings some opera. So Mike has a very prominent role in all of the shows. You know, they were doing that Madison Square Garden thing that just came to an end, I think. But every month for years, Billy played MSG, which
so
I think
cool.
is amazing. All right, let's see what Joe Biden had to say at the UN today. This is what he said.
Since October 7, we've also been determined to prevent a wider war that engulfs the entire region. Hezbollah, unprovoked, joined the October 7 attack, launching rockets into Israel. Almost a year later, too many on each side of the Israeli-Lebanon border remain displaced. A full-scale war is not in anyone's interest. Even if the situation has escalated, a diplomatic solution is still possible.
Well, I think we only get half of that because he's hard to understand these days. But former Missouri Senator Jim Talent is back with us this afternoon to talk about that and a number of other issues. How are you this afternoon, Jim?
I'm doing well, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with what's going on with Hezbollah and that situation right now with Israel, because, you know, you and I have talked about and you've talked about the possibility of Hezbollah getting more involved. Now that seemingly has happened. It's hard kind of to keep track on where all this is in Israel just because of the busy news cycle. And here we are coming up with the 1 year anniversary of the horrible massacre that occurred last year and how this all started. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and this increasing level of conflict with Hezbollah was inevitable. Let me just go over the context, okay? So after October 7th, Hezbollah began shooting rockets consistently at Israel. It was part of an effort to prevent Israel from achieving its war aims in Hamas by forcing them to stop short of forcing them to stop short of destroying Hamas. It was combined with an international pressure campaign in which the United States fitfully participated. So that didn't work because Israel has largely accomplished its goals in Gaza and is now turning north, which it has to do because there are about 60 to 100,000 Israelis displaced by this. They're being attacked by their neighbor. So Israel is taking out Hezbollah's command and control. That was the whole incident with the pagers and the walkie-talkies. They're taking out their top-level commanders. They've gotten the head. They just most recently got the head of the rocket force. And now they're taking out as many of their rockets and their launchers as they can get through the air and they're very substantially degrading them. We don't know exactly how many, but the reports that I've seen are that the Israelis are very pleased. They may have destroyed about half of Hezbollah's capabilities. Hezbollah is responding, trying to attack Israeli cities. And yesterday they launched a missile at Tel Aviv, which is like Israel's New York, and it was intercepted by Iron Dome. But right. We can expect the conflict to continue, and I expect that Israel will eventually go in on the ground.
So that scenario has been discussed obviously previously. And you know what's interesting to me, and obviously I'm not an expert, you are, but I think, Sue, you might even agree, this whole discussion about the 60,000 Israelis that were displaced in the north, that really has not been discussed very much. So
nope.
All of a sudden that's being talked about and is a legitimate part of all of this discussion. But, you know, it's complicated because I feel like I'm still asking some of the same questions, like, what's the end game? Is there going to be a ground war? It seems like a lot of this is still somewhat undetermined. At least the timing of it certainly is.
Yeah, that's a fair point, the actual end game. I mean, the minimum Israel's going to have to do is push Hezbollah back beyond the Litani River, which is about 15 to 20 kilometers north of the Israeli border, because as long as they're there, even if Israel were to take out all of Hezbollah's capability, they'd simply be resupplied by Iran and then would begin attacking again. So I think Israel's going to have to do that as a minimum. They're going to have to create a buffer zone which will put Israel outside of short-range and medium-range rockets, the rockets that Hezbollah has. Now, the issue is, will Israel go after Iran specifically? Because Iran is the head of the snake, or the head of the octopus, if you will. They're the ones who've established these proxies. The proxies serve Iran's broader regional goals, which go far beyond Israel. And these proxies, especially Hezbollah, they're basically a puppet. They don't make a move without Iran. And then the other issue is what role the United States will play.
Well, and that's a very good question to get to right now, because what is specifically the administration's position on all this currently? It's a little hard to figure it out, isn't it?
Well, if you ask Kamala Harris, she'll just keep repeating that we're going to get a deal. We're going to get a deal. But the problem is that you have two parties with irreconcilably conflicting goals. The one party wants to destroy Israel, and Israel would like to survive. It's pretty hard to get a deal there. Now, what we should have been doing is, at minimum, strongly and consistently supporting Israel's narrative and giving them such help with supplies, you know, military supplies as we could, although they don't need that as much. The issue for us is also what to do about Iran. We should have been constraining Iran for the last 4 years, weakening them, enforcing Trump's maximum pressure campaign against them was the way to go. And you notice we have, they have committed a casus belli against the United States. Their proxies kidnapped 5 Americans, killed one of them, and they've been attacking American forces in the region. So, you know, I'll give you an idea of what Reagan would have done. What he did do in the late 80s, when this kind of thing happened, he sank about a quarter of the Iranian Navy, and then the attack stopped. So, but at minimum, we should have been strongly supporting the Israelis, and we should be doing that now.
But are you suggesting, look, I want to get to this this question of whether or not we should have military involvement more directly, but here's what President Trump said. I thought this would get your attention.
But if I were the president, I would inform the threatening country, in this case, Iran, that if you do anything to harm this person, we are going to blow your largest cities and the country itself to smithereens.
Back in the day, we used to call that a little saber rattling, right? But that is a former president rattling pretty hard on that saber, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah, and that's it's typical Trump hyperbole, but hyperbole in support of the right point. Look, if we were to decide, he may be referring to the assassination threats, which is another causes belli, and they're very real.
Yeah.
Very real. I mean, the FBI is very worried about it. What would happen if we had a president who wanted to take strong action to deter Iran, which is really what punishing them would do under these circumstances? You have a number of options. So one of them would be to go after their assets at sea. Another would be to go after, for example, the port through which they ship their oil. And they're shipping a lot more oil because we're not enforcing the sanctions. So you can have a range of different options, up to and including attacking their nuclear infrastructure. If they thought you were going to do that, I think these attacks would stop. right away. So Trump's basic point is absolutely correct. I mean, this is not, on the highest strategic level, this is not that difficult. Iran is activating its proxies in support of Iranian national objectives. They're the puppet master. There's a big debate in Israel right now about whether Israeli forces should go after Iran on their own. To this point, the government is just taking on the proxies one after another, which is the minimum it has to do for the country to survive. I mean, these really are existential attacks, Mark. I mean, the attack that occurred on October 7th killed 1,200 people. Israel only has 10 million people.
Right.
So yep. If it was an attack on the United States, you'd multiply that by 35. It'd be 35,000 people dead. What do you think we'd do?
Yeah, well, there'd be a strong response. There's no doubt about that. Former Senator Jim Talent is here, absolute expert on foreign policy. So one of the first things I heard this morning is that China test-fired an ICBM into the Pacific Ocean. They hadn't really done something long-range like that, I understand, since 1980. Is that true? So what do you make of all this, speaking of saber rattling?
I didn't sure it wasn't North Korea. Anyway,
no, they say China.
Okay. It's possible. I mean, they are vastly increasing their nuclear arsenal. Well above what anybody's predicted. They've consistently been ahead in terms of numbers and timetable of anything the CIA thought they could do. There's a lot of speculation about why they're doing it. I don't think they're trying to acquire first strike capability. I don't think that fits in with their plans. What they're doing is using their regionally dominant conventional power to achieve their objective, which is to control in the first step, to control East Asia and the East and South China Sea. But I think what this is part of is they only had a small nuclear arsenal. And it was because they'd always said under Mao and the succeeding leaders that they just wanted retaliatory capacity. I think Xi Jinping feels like, well, you know what? We got a world-class military. We're going to have a world-class nuclear arsenal. The danger of it is, there's a lot of dangers to it, but one of them is they're co-locating their nuclear missiles with their conventional missiles on the Chinese mainland. So if there were to be a war over Taiwan and an adversary were to try and take out the missile sites from which they were attacking our ships, we would have to attack the same locations where they have their nuclear weapons. And that's the kind of thing that can lead to a mistake,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that sounds complicated.
It's not number one on my list of concerns, but it does show that, they're engaged in the biggest military buildup, I don't know, since before World War II at minimum.
Well, let me take you back quickly here, though, before I let you go to Iran, because apparently I haven't seen this video, but I guess there was a video that Iran made in 2022 that depicts an assassination attempt against Donald Trump while he plays a round of golf. And that started making the rounds again today because, as you alluded to, you have, you know, more information that Tehran is behind plots to possibly take his life. So this is another interesting aspect of this, because when it comes to reaction or retaliation for something like this, what do you do? How do you diplomatically handle something like that?
Well, you don't just do it diplomatically. I mean,
yeah.
You know, when Saddam Hussein was threatening former President H.W. Bush, Clinton took retaliatory action. I believe it was a missile strike. What you do is, in the lexicon, it's called imposing costs and consequences. In other words, you hurt them in ways that lead them to believe, you know, it really would have been better if we hadn't made those threats. And as I said before, there's a range of options that we could use militarily if you wanted to do that. The minimum we should be doing is maximum pressure on them economically, freezing their assets, really enforcing the oil sanctions. I mean, Trump had their foreign reserves way down. Their economy was in the door. They didn't have the money to arm their proxies. That's the least we should be doing. And I think the time may be coming pretty soon, given how aggressive they're getting, when we're going to have to consider doing something else. But if your policy is to try and build a partnership with them, which is what the Biden administration has been trying to do in the last 4 years, well, they just take that as weakness. And that just encourages aggression, which is what we've seen.
Absolutely. Jim Talent, always great to have you on. I hope all is well. Our best to your wife, Brenda, and we will talk soon, Jim.
Thanks, Mark.
All right, take care. I wanted to get into a little bit more of that video. I have not seen the video, but here's how it's described. It's an animated video. This is something that they created in 2022, Iran, but again, I guess it kind of made it the rounds again today. It opens on an image of an American flag waving in the breeze above Trump's house at Mar-a-Lago, his residence at Mar-a-Lago in West Palm Beach. And then it zooms in on Trump swinging a golf club as advisors, including former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, look on. So Trump lines up a shot. A remote-controlled weapon rolls into view, piloted by Iranian operators who hacked Mar-a-Lago's security system to let it onto the property. The robotic system, which is depicted to include cameras and targeting lasers, then closes in on this animated video on Trump and Pompeo, and they target them Minority Report style. Remember, I even referenced
That's
that movie
it.
Earlier today.
Minority
we couldn't
Report.
Remember the name of it, right? With red squares as the phrases gun ready and laser ready appear on the screen. That's pretty serious there. I'd probably argue that this story in and of itself, because there's more here, I guess there's a special operator in the distance in the video that is shown sending a text message reading Soleimani's murderer and the one who gave the order will pay the price, because this is in retaliation for, you know, the assassination of Soleimani, which happened in 2020. And that was something that was directed by the U.S. So then the animation ends as the words revenge is definite appear on the screen. And it's pretty, you know, I think it's pretty alarming. But I guess what I was going to say is, if you had the same story, because let's face it, I think that's undercovered right now.
Oh,
that
yeah.
whole aspect is under.
For sure.
This should be one of the biggest stories in this country right now. It really should. I think David Strom at hotair.com wrote about it and said, this is like the biggest story around right now. Nobody's really talking about it. I think they talk about it a little bit more if we had some other people that were involved here, if you know what I mean. 522, Dan O'Donnell is up at WISN in Milwaukee. I used to be up there, work with Dan, and he is a talk show host in his own right. We're getting an update on that swing state and some of the electoral shenanigans going on coming up next.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age. Wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. MIDI clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. MIDI offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, M-I-D-I. com.
Never seen this band, Bare Naked Ladies, but I will tonight. At the Factory in Chesterfield with Toad the Wet Sprocket. Should be a good show. A little bumper music this afternoon.
I met you.
And you can always find the entire list of bumper music. There's at least two or three of you out there that search on the Twitter for my bumper music list, which I post every day at the end of the show. You can always follow at Mark Reardon KFTK. I still have an audio cut of the day coming up before the end of the hour. We have a Reardon Roundtable set for Friday. A lot to talk about. We got a vice presidential debate next week. Jane will be here Friday. Former Chief of Staff for Mayor Slay, Jeff Rainford, and GOP consultant David Barklage, all on Friday afternoon starting at 3. So Senator Ron Johnson, who is one of the senators from a state that I lived in, Wisconsin, is saying that it's not accidental that voter rolls in the cheese state remain filled with dead people and voters that have moved out of state, like maybe me, maybe I'm on the voter rolls up there. We're going to find out. Dan O'Donnell, my friend from Milwaukee, does a talk show at WISN, is back with us this afternoon. Dan, how are you? It's been a little bit.
It has. First of all, I do have a bit of a bone to pick with you. You've never seen the Bare Naked Ladies before?
I never
have.
How is
that even possible?
Like, not even at Summerfest or anything like that? I know, it's kind of shameful, because you know my musical roots run deep, but
yes.
that's not a band I've ever seen. I've seen Toad before, but that kind of goes back a couple of decades, too.
Well, I got to tell you, you're in for a treat, even though Stephen Page, one of the two original singers, hasn't been with the band for a good, oh boy, at least a decade now. They still put on a great show. I've seen them at least two or three times. One at the old Bradley Center back at the height of their fame in like the early 2000s.
That's awesome.
They're a fun band. Yes, we not only have what how many hundred thousand names are still on our voter rolls, people who are deceased, people who have moved out of the state. I'm not sure if you saw this in our capital city of Madison, one of the most heavily Democratic cities in the entire country by percentage of Dem votes, just sent out 2,215 duplicate ballots. Just oops, human error, they're saying.
It's great.
Not much we can do. So we've got a whole bunch of people who are still on the voter rolls, and now we've got 2,000 ballots just sort of in the wild that somebody could use to fill out in the name of one of those people.
But in theory, so I don't know exactly how this works, and I'm not sure how much they've cleaned it up. I left Milwaukee in 2006. I moved back here to St. Louis. I registered to vote. I've voted here ever since. But in theory, could I potentially still be on the voter rolls, or even someone more recently that's moved away that then, not that people would actually take the trouble to go 800 miles or whatever the distance might be, but they could possibly still vote?
You would not still be on the voter rolls because they are required by law. Well, they're required by law to essentially clean them up every month.
Okay.
So what goes on under state law is they'll send a postcard to your voting address. And if you don't fill it out and send it back, basically saying, yes, I'm still here, don't take me off the rolls, they're supposed to clean up that name instantly. Well, they don't do it. And this is the second straight presidential election cycle that they've refused to do it. They have done it a number of times since then. So you would almost certainly be off. I'm trying to think, people I know that are deceased several years ago are probably off. But somebody who just moved out of the state, for example, I am in between homes right now. Sadly, I'm homeless. I'm kidding. I'm living with my in-laws while we're building a house. So technically, the Dan O'Donnell who still lives at my old address is on the rolls.
Right.
Because I haven't updated my address. Now, you would think that once I change my address, the voter roll would be changed. No, it is my understanding there will still be a Dan O'Donnell who lived at my old address on the voter rolls, and then a Dan O'Donnell at my temporary address with my in-laws. And then when we finally move into our new house in December or January, there will be a third Dan O'Donnell at a third different address until the rolls are cleaned up.
Well, you have a
sense?
Yeah, a little bit, but you have a Democrat governor. So, the way that Ron Johnson's complaining about this is that they're playing kind of, dirty pool in Madison with this, which would not be surprising, right?
Oh, that's it exactly. In fact, one of our congressmen, Tom Tiffany, just came out and started raising holy you-know-what about the Madison duplicate ballots. In fact, I actually just got the exact opposite thing happen in another heavily Democratic city, a suburb of Milwaukee called Wauwatosa, right? And I'm sure you remember it very fondly. It's gotten infinitely more liberal since you left, Mark. I actually had a number of reports, people who said that they got their mail-in ballot envelope. The voter instructions were there how to mail it back, but the return envelope and the ballot itself were gone, just completely out of it. The Wauwatosa City Hall says, well, we think there was an issue with the adhesive, that once the thing got in the mail, that the envelope just opened. And one of my sources goes, okay, the instructions were still in there miraculously, but all of the stuff you would need to fill out and return my ballot are gone. And what we're seeing here, Mark, is the ultimate problem with mail-in voting. There just is no chain of custody. There is too much that can happen. I mean, how many times have you lost something in the mail or something got delayed or, a package shows up and it's been opened or tampered
right.
with or broken in some way? It happens. It doesn't happen frequently, but it happens. And this is why Republicans here in Wisconsin, I think across the country, are saying, look, wait a second. We had a pretty darn good system. Even in-person absentee voting is a good system because you put the ballot in a secure location where it sits until Election Day, where it's finally opened up and then counted, right? Mail-in balloting, it's like there's just all these ballots kind of in the wild. Nobody has any idea where those duplicate ballots from Madison are, by the way. We think most of them are still with the people who got them. We think most of those people shredded them or threw them out.
But you don't know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it. We don't know. We have no idea.
Dan, let's talk a little broader about Wisconsin in the role of this presidential race. And you know, one of the things, and you and I have talked about this before too, but I've shared these numbers before, and I think they're illustrative, so I'm going to share them again. In 2012, Mitt Romney got 1.4 million votes. Obama got 1.6 million in Wisconsin. All right. In 2016, Hillary Clinton received 239,000 fewer votes than Barack Obama. Almost a quarter million people stayed home and did not vote for Hillary Clinton. Trump only got, actually, you know what, if I look at the numbers, Romney had more votes than Trump in 2012. Yep. You wouldn't believe that. Like, most people wouldn't even think that that's possible, but Trump had fewer votes. But it was people who stayed home. That's what made the difference, not only in Wisconsin, but Michigan and some other states as well, African-American voters in particular. So what is the climate right now? When I watch focus groups with black people asked about Kamala Harris, they don't trust her very much. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not thinking a majority of African-Americans are going to vote for Donald Trump, but a small number could make a difference. So tell me what's going to happen in Wisconsin. Lay it out for me, Dan.
Well, in 2016, one of the big reasons that Hillary Clinton's vote total went down was the presence of Jill Stein of the Green Party on the ballot. She got about 33,000 votes, which rather obviously would have gone to Hillary Clinton. It's a far left party, environmental and all that. In 2020, our state elections commission voted to keep both Jill Stein and Kanye West off of the ballot in Wisconsin. As a result, Trump won Wisconsin by about 20,000 votes, fewer than the number that Jill Stein got. Trump lost Wisconsin in 2020 by about 20,000 votes. In 2024, Jill Stein and Cornel West are still on the ballot. Mm. However, so too is Bobby Kennedy Jr. And I'm not sure what kind of an issue this is going to pose, since most people know Kennedy is out of the race. He's endorsing Trump. But another name on the ballot who could theoretically draw from Trump, along with the, I'm calling him a lino, libertarian in name only, Chase Oliver, who's just a psychotic liberal who decided to run as a libertarian. And I don't know if libertarians just aren't paying attention to see who this guy is. He's on the ballot, too. My guess is that we're going to see a decline in turnout in Wisconsin and across the country as compared with 2020. And it's probably shaping up to be closer to 2016. When you talk about black voters and Hispanic voters in Wisconsin, this is actually something that I've noticed too, especially black and Hispanic males. You would be shocked at the number you would see walking around Milwaukee. I was downtown for a couple of events past couple of weeks, and you'll just see dudes walking around in Trump shirts. It's
wow.
Just, you know, black dude, inner city Milwaukee, just walking around Trump hat. During the RNC, I was pretty much taking Ubers exclusively, and I got in a great conversation with my driver, black dude. He's been in Milwaukee forever, like 50-some years old. And weirdly enough, he's on the phone with his buddy, who's a long-haul truck driver out in the Las Vegas area. And they're talking, and they figure out what I do, and we're just kind of talking about politics and the RNC. And they both said, they're like, yeah, man, you know, I didn't really like Trump, but I got to tell you, this was right after the first assassination attempt. They say, man, that was a pretty badass thing that he did, standing up. Like, it just, for whatever reason, he is getting a higher percentage of black and Hispanic support. And when you combine that with just the overwhelming support of men, especially men with no college degree or some college, I just think if that support is in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, it's going to be really tough. I mean, I saw some polling in the Sun Belt that makes me think, I don't want to say Trump's a lock in Georgia and Arizona and Nevada and North Carolina, but he's looking very strong. Then he only has to win one of the Rust Belt states. And it's looking like he's very, very well positioned in Pennsylvania, more so than Wisconsin and Michigan. I just think the polling is going to start to reflect what I think we've sort of been seeing. And that is, Trump's a lot stronger than people think.
Well, that could be. There's no doubt about that. But, I mean, dirty tricks will abound here in the next couple of months. I think you would agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. And this is why forbearance is the watchword, right? You just really have to make sure, especially in swing states like Wisconsin, that when this sort of stuff happens, it's brought to light immediately, that these ballots just can't be used to vote, that everybody knows that you know, people are watching and aren't going to tolerate the same sort of stuff that happened in 2020, where rules and laws were just overtly broken to give Democrats an advantage.
Going to be interesting to watch, Dan. Thank you for jumping on here with me this afternoon. Let me touch on two more very important topics. First, and we don't have to discuss this one a lot, but I will offer congratulations to you and the city of Milwaukee for clinching the National League Central. The St. Louis Cardinals apparently decided not to play baseball this year, and we're rather disturbed about that. But on a more positive note that we can kind of agree on, dude, Malik Willis and the Packers.
Yeah. Oh,
holy smokes. Who would have thought that would have happened? And is Jordan going to play this weekend? Do we know?
I think the plan is for him to get the start. I'm assuming they're going to call him a game-time decision. For all the talk about how great Malik Willis is, there is no quarterback controversy in Green Bay. Jordan Love is the starter. It's great to have a backup.
Oh, absolutely.
Like Malik, who was just incredible. I mean, it was something of a revenge game for him. Tennessee basically gave up on him, trading him to the Packers during training camp because they went with Will Levis. It just goes to show you, I think, Mark, not just with Malik Willis, but take a look at Sam Darnold in Minnesota. Take a look at Baker Mayfield in Tampa Bay.
New surroundings, well, right?
Yeah, Jared Goff. Look at Jared Goff. I mean, yeah, he went to a Super Bowl with the Rams, but he really came into his own with Detroit. When you have the right system around you and you have – I think there was an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago to this effect. When you have the right system and
I saw that story. Yeah.
It's amazing what can happen, and I think Malik Willis is a testament to that. He's also just an incredibly good man, a devout Christian who always tweets out Bible verses. He's just someone who's so easy to root for.
He's impressive. It's been fun to watch, and I'm amazed, you know, watching from afar that the Packers, you know, because this could have been a really devastating start with high hopes for this season. All right, Dan, well, as you know, I have a Whitefish Bay native for a wife and very fond of the Milwaukee Brewers, and I grew pretty close with the team when I was there. I can root for the Brewers in this postseason since the Cardinals are not involved. So that's my commitment. Go Pack, go, and we'll see what happens. We'll have you back for the election, certainly. Thank you, Danny.
Always my pleasure, my friend. Go enjoy the Bare Naked Ladies.
I will. I will do that tonight. Oh, another reminder that my friend Mike Del Judas, who is in Billy Joel's band, he's a rhythm guitar player. He sings background vocals. Billy lets him solo during the show as well. He's going to be with us in the 4 o'clock hour tomorrow. We're going to keep our fingers crossed on the weather for Friday and that show. We got the Evolution Festival this weekend. A lot going on in St. Louis. We don't want it to be canceled. So we'll have Dave Murray tomorrow after we got this hurricane that is moving up the... I'm trying to determine where it is. I looked at the satellite image.
I just texted
my friend Tim McGowan, who we visit down in Captiva. He's got restaurants down there, and of course they got hammered 2 years ago, right?
Yeah,
has that been
did.
2 years now? Maybe even three. No, I think it's 2 years. So this one looks pretty serious. I think they're saying category three, and you know, all the rain that we're going to get on Friday is sort of pushing up the coast and into the rest of the country, and that's where a lot of these heavy rainfalls are going to come from. So we'll get you updated on that tomorrow. Let's see. I had one more topic that I wanted to do here, and I'm going to see if I can squeeze it in before audio cut of the day. This is kind of an amazing story when you think about it, and they wrote about it on hotair.com. We've heard stories like this before, but here we have a coffee shop owner at Boise State University.
Okay.
Who just won $4 million in a judgment there. She had claimed that the school forced her to close the shop after a controversy erupted over support for police. Did I cover this story yesterday, Sue? The thin blue line? Because now I'm having second thoughts that I did this one yesterday.
Well, no, I think you're okay.
Okay. I love the story so much. So, Sarah Fendley is her name. She opens this coffee store called Big City Coffee on the campus of Boise State in 2020. In the window of her store was a very small sticker, the thin blue line sticker, you know, the flag that symbolizes support for police officers.
Yeah.
So a student or students, but maybe it was just one student, noticed the sticker, and one person wrote a message on her Snapchat account asking fellow students not to visit.
Because of that?
Yeah. This is what these, you know, ratty kids on college campuses do. So Sarah Fendley was sent a copy of the message. She addressed it directly on social media. And she said, "I remember feeling defeated. I said, okay, I'm going to address it. I always address these things. And in her post, she talked about what the thin blue line means to her and how a shooting left her former fiance, Kevin Holtry, paralyzed. He's a former Boise PD officer who was shot by a suspect in a gunfight in 2016. He's paralyzed. Now, they were engaged at the time when she did this. They're no longer engaged, but that's not really the important part of the story. The post comes up the following morning, October 22nd, 2020, in a class that is actually being taught by the president of Boise State University, Marlene Trump. And Fenley had cropped the screenshot to not include the student's name, you know, because she didn't want the student to be doxxed, as they call it. But what happened was, is because of all this, it creates a firestorm. She's pulled into a meeting with university administrators. And part of that conversation was apparently recorded by one of the administrators, but not the conclusion of it. So you have lawyers that are involved in this case that are telling two different sides of the story about how it ended. And what she's claiming is the university terminated her contract because of her support for the police.
Well, that is...
Yeah, and her lawyer's like, hey, this clearly violates free speech rights. So this all happened, keep in mind, many years ago. Last Friday, they had a decision in court, and there was... she testified in this, and they have decided to award her $3 million for lost business, reputational damage, mental and emotional distress, and personal humiliation, and an additional $1 million in punitive damages against the school and the vice president of student affairs.
Good.
Is absolutely. This is very similar to the Gibson's Bakery case from Oberlin College, but some snot-nosed little anti-defund the police student at Boise State, you know, that had tattoos and, you know, no hair. And there's no doubt that there was a couple of lip piercings involved, too. Goes to Snapchat and starts ripping on this woman, and she gets $4 million out of the deal. That is glorious. Ugh. That is a great, great story here as we wrap up on a Wednesday afternoon.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
Okay, let's see if I have time for a couple things here. Joe Biden was on The View with a bunch of people that you know are going to ask him tough questions this morning, right? Joe Behar and the gang. And see if he can make sense of this. Now, I'll play something that maybe puts this into further context, but he says this about why'd you drop out, Joe?
The greatest honor in the world sitting behind the Resolute desk as President of the United States, but I loved it, but... Sounds corny, but I love my country more.
That's right. That's just an incredible.
That's right. That is incredible. We love you, Joe. You love your country. So what does that mean? Why you love your country? So why did you get out? Did that answer the question? So they asked him about this. This will come full circle. They asked him about his relationship with Pelosi.
Did you feel that your hand was forced? And what is your relationship with Speaker Pelosi now?
My relationship is fine. Look, I never fully believed the assertions that somehow there was this overwhelming reluctance of my running again. I didn't sense that. There were some folks who would like to see me step aside so they have a chance to move on. I get that. That's just human nature. But that wasn't the reason that I stepped down.
And he really never said the reason, I don't think. He was trying to do it for the country. But overwhelming reluctance, there was.
Yeah, I mean, people
Uncle
came
Joe.
Out and said it publicly.
Yeah, like Barack Obama.
Yeah.
George Clooney wrote an op-ed that was in the New York Times. There was a little teamwork involved here, Joe, to push you out. Is he in complete... Now, we would understand that he can be in complete denial about this.
I wonder if he was even exposed to it. You know, his wife may have kept it from... Who knows?
You know, Sue, you say that, but that is a very controlled environment. And maybe because we were all so confused, let's face it, in the weeks, and there were only a couple of them, maybe 3 weeks in the aftermath of that first debate, everyone was so stunned. And nobody on the Democrat side thought it was a good idea that he stay in the race. Was there overwhelming reluctance? Absolutely, there was overwhelming reluctance. I mean, it was at all-time highs, which is why they got him out of the race. Anyway, I'm off to the Bare Naked Ladies and Toe the Wet Sprocket. We'll talk tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Have a great Wednesday night.
Get more at 971talk.com.